The unexpected discovery of a structural defect in some train cars has cut SEPTA's regional rail capacity by a third. I'm Brad Linder, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller's off this evening. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has the latest on SEPTA's ongoing attempts to keep people moving for fireworks tonight and for commutes tomorrow morning.
Late Friday night, a SEPTA engineer noticed one regional rail car was listing to the side, out of line with its neighbors. A follow-up inspection showed that the car had a dangerous crack in a load-bearing beam, as did nearly all of the Silverliner 5 model cars SEPTA uses.
We have inspected the 120 cars. We have five good cars.
That's Ron Hopkins, SEPTA's Assistant General Manager of Operations.
But because of the number of cracks we've had on the other vehicles, before we return even those vehicles, we want to do more extensive testing.
The Transit Authority immediately removed all of the Silverliner 5s from service. Light travel on the holiday weekend means riders haven't felt the pinch yet. But Tuesday morning rush hour will be a different story, says Matthew Mitchell of the Delaware Valley Association of Rail Passengers.
The worst of the impacts actually are going to be on the inner parts of the lines, not necessarily individual lines. They're likely to be particularly bad for passengers being passed up because trains are already full.
SEPTA officials say that during rush hour, they could experience a 30 to 50% drop in capacity. At a news conference Monday afternoon, Hopkins rolled out the authority's contingency plan to serve regional rail commuters.
SEPTA will operate a modified Saturday schedule during all weekdays, Monday through Friday, until further notice.
He says extra trips will be added in the early morning, as well as during rush hours, to try to siphon off some of the heavy flow. During peak weekday travel hours, Hopkins encouraged riders to take alternate routes whenever possible.
We have a very vast transit network with all our rail lines, the subways, our 118 bus routes. We really are encouraging our regional rail riders to move towards our other parts of our system.
The two subway lines will extend rush hour service to handle any additional burden, and SEPTA has opened up free parking at Columbus Boulevard and Spring Garden, as well as the Navy Hospital in South Philly, so people can park and ride more easily. Looking ahead to the end of the month, Hopkins downplayed any impact on the Democratic National Convention when Philadelphia will be on the national stage.
We feel that a lot of people that want to go down and witness the event will use our Broad Street subway, so we have additional service on that.
Still, he says to expect regional rail to be on the reduced schedule through the summer.
Through the rest of the month, and right now we're planning on having it through August also.
Tonight's concert and fireworks on Benjamin Franklin Parkway will be unimpeded. SEPTA was already running on a holiday schedule and added extra trips for people leaving late. Matthew Mitchell from the Rail Passengers Association urges riders coming back from vacation to be prepared and to telecommute or flex their hours if possible.
There's probably a large number of people who are off on vacation. They're going to come back tonight and assume that their train is going to be there for them at the regular time on Tuesday morning. And they're going to get a pretty big surprise.
SEPTA officials say they'll have the most up-to-date schedules on their website, SEPTA.org. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Tune in to Morning Edition tomorrow on WHYY for a check on the first day's commute with reduced service. Philadelphia officials say they're committed to shrinking the county jail population, but an increasing percentage of inmates are being held on detainer orders, which often stem from technical violations of probation or parole. CityandStatePA.com reporter Ryan Briggs examined the situation recently and joined us to take a closer look. He spoke with Newsworks Tonight host Dave Heller.
Ryan, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
And we're talking primarily about low-level offenders.
Well, what we found in our analysis is that about one in three inmates who are detained for probation or parole violations are sitting in jail for misdemeanor or lesser charges, so not necessarily a felony charge, not necessarily a violent crime.
And that one-third level is up significantly over the past decade?
That's correct. We found that while the jail population overall has gone down, the proportion of people who are in jail for probation or parole violations has gone up over the past 5 years or so.
So explain this notion of a detainer order, or what you refer to as a detention trap.
Right. So, I mean, essentially what this is, it's a punishment for violating some stricture of probation or parole. For instance, if you are arrested again, that could be a violation of your probation or parole. If you show up late to meetings, if you fail a drug test, those are all, you know, different kinds of violations. What some criminal defense attorneys will tell you is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of rhyme or reason for when the probation department detains people for those violations. And in some instances, like the gentleman that we profile in this article, you have people who are detained indefinitely who don't necessarily have a violent criminal background and didn't necessarily do anything violent that might otherwise warrant them being held in county lockup for an indefinite period of time.
Tell us a bit about the specifics of Jose Ribot.
In Jose's case, we found that he had accepted a plea deal for an arrest some years ago around a drug charge and had gotten several years of probation. He was arrested again years later on another drug charge for selling a gram of heroin, but otherwise didn't have a violent background. And he wound up being detained in the county holding cells for 18 months before his case went to trial. So in this instance, it meant that a person who wasn't necessarily the riskiest kind of criminal that we see was taking up a bed at the county detention center for over a year.
That 18-month period, was that at the outside of what you observed, or some are held even longer than that?
That would be on the high end. I believe the city told us that the average length of stay was around 100 days, but that's still a very long time. And if the city is saying now, you know, that we don't have space in jails to keep every offender locked up until their trial and that we need to be prioritizing, you can see how detaining people on these sometimes technical violations or even just, you know, nonviolent offenses can contribute to the overcrowding in the Philadelphia prison system.
Your piece does touch on the greater consideration about whether we're treating drug offenders as criminals or folks with a medical issue.
Yeah, I mean, and I would say one area where Jose and the probation officials agreed is that the drug war presents a serious obstacle to true criminal justice reform, because we arrest tens of thousands of people every year or more on drug crimes, nonviolent crimes in many instances. And if you're someone with a substance abuse issue who is being repeatedly arrested for drug possession because of the habit that you have, systems like probation and parole and the detention that comes along with that can be very punishing. And you can have people who, instead of getting treatment for addiction, are instead getting indefinite lockup without bail at a county jail.
Ryan, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
CityandStatePA.com reporter Ryan Briggs. You can hear more of our conversation at NewsWorks.org.
And Briggs. Ryan Briggs spoke with NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller. Like Philadelphia, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is grappling with a growing jail population, including many inmates waiting for mental health treatment. If a person is found unfit to stand trial, federal guidelines say they can wait up to a week in jail before receiving treatment. But in eastern Pennsylvania, that wait often stretches for up to a year. That may change with the settlement of an ACLU lawsuit. WHYY's Kyrie Greenberg reports new supportive housing options are being developed to help the newly released return to society and reduce strain on state hospitals.
The plaintiff in the ACLU's lawsuit, J.H., is a homeless man who was arrested for stealing personal care items like soap. After being found unfit to stand trial, he waited a year in jail before being sent to Norristown State Hospital, and then was released on probation to a homeless shelter.
Within a couple of days, he left the shelter, which was a violation of his probation, and moved into a little wooded area in the parking lot behind the shelter. And then a couple of weeks later, he's caught by a convenience store manager stealing 3 peppermint patty candies. The police are called. They see that he's now violated his probation, and so he's taken back into the system to go through that cycle again.
That's Vic Walchek, legal director of the ACLU. He says J.H.'s story illustrates a larger problem. On average, 225 mentally incompetent Pennsylvanians wait in jails for one of 175 beds to become available. And whether they have committed a minor offense or a violent crime, all are treated at one of two high-security facilities. Once released from there, they often receive little community support. Ted Dallas, Secretary of Pennsylvania's Department of Human Services, says bridging the gap between a high-security hospital and a homeless shelter should help cut recidivism.
It is extraordinarily difficult to get out of poverty if you don't have affordable, sustainable housing, and at the same time, too, if you're trying to address a mental illness and you don't have stable housing, it becomes even harder to deal with that issue.
To meet the terms of the settlement, DHS has invested $5 million in step-down residential programs and acute care facilities. This money created 50 beds in Philadelphia last week and guarantees another 30. The city's behavioral health department has contributed another $1 million towards 100 new supportive housing slots over the next 3 years. DHS reports that for the first time in at least two administrations, the waitlist numbers are starting to go down. Walchek says that if your crime was stealing candy, the state is wasting money putting that person in a high-security facility.
We're hopefully going to spread out the people who need services across the entire spectrum of mental health care, but it's also a win for the state and for the taxpayers because the most expensive bed you can have is one at Norristown State Hospital where it's $900 a day. For that money, you could provide comprehensive services and housing to 5 or 6 people in the community.
Dallas of DHS says offering supportive housing and expanding residential treatment indicates a larger change in the criminal justice system.
We're headed in the right direction, and all of that is possible because of the partners in the system, whether it be the courts, the district attorney's office, the public defender. There are lots of players who have impact in the system, and we need to have all those folks on the same page, and I think we do.
For WHYY News, I'm Kyrie Greenberg.
Still ahead, as Americans gear up to watch 4th of July fireworks tonight, you'll be able to catch a second sky show later in the week.
You'll be able to see Jupiter just above a crescent moon, and by Saturday, you'll be able to see how the moon in its orbit has passed by Jupiter.
It's time to look to the night sky with Sky Talk. That's coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
The Penn Museum supports WHYY. The Penn Museum is so much more than mummies. From an exhibition brimming with treasures from ancient Turkey to sweet sounds from summer evening concerts, the Penn Museum unearths the story of humankind through diverse programming, interactive exhibitions, and 3 floors of art and artifacts from around the world. There are so many reasons to tour the Penn Museum this summer. Details at www.penn.museum.
Financial news changes by the very minute. Domestic and global markets are crazy.
China's not about to move away from buying U.S. Treasuries.
The European Central Bank wading into the Spanish and Italian government bond market today.
The whole debt ceiling debate made us look dysfunctional. We all know that.
That's okay, though, because we're here. Marketplace. It's the business show for the rest of us. It's from APM, American Public Media.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Brad Linder, in for Dave Heller. Every year, paddlers take a sojourn down the length of the Schuylkill River, from Schuylkill Haven to Philadelphia. As the river bends and flows through 135 miles of southeastern Pennsylvania, it picks up a lot of rubbish. This year, one paddler had a special mission, mapping all the trash strewn along the way. Virginia Vassalotti with the Schuylkill Action Network says her group launched the project to try to educate the public.
This year, we wanted to do something more, not just clean up the litter after it's already there, you know, learn more about the problem and try and figure out ways that we can prevent litter from entering our waterways.
Their hope is by putting garbage data in, they'll encourage local groups to take garbage out of the river. A map of the trash hotspots is on their website. This year's 4th of July offers out-of-doors celebrants the opportunity to take in a doubleheader. Fireworks at nightfall, and then the nature's pyrotechnics until dawn. Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, gave a preview to NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller.
Derek, happy holiday, and let's get busy. Where should we look in the overnight sky?
Happy holiday to you too, Dave. So this is a great week for summer celestial observing. We have
All the wonderful stars of the summer sky available right now. We can start directly overhead with the constellation Cygnus the Swan. It's a large cross-shaped constellation that sort of stretches along the Milky Way. And as it takes us down toward the southern end of the sky, we end up at a constellation called Sagittarius. And on just to the right of Sagittarius is Scorpius. Now, that constellation marks the location of two bright planets. There's Saturn that's visible right there and Mars that's visible right there. But a little bit further over is Jupiter. It's easily seen in the west just after sunset. And on Friday night of this week, you'll be able to see Jupiter just above a crescent moon. And by Saturday, you'll be able to see how the moon in its orbit has passed by Jupiter. So on one day, you'll see it on one side of the moon. The next day, you'll see it on the other side of the moon.
What magnification would you need to see Juno on Jupiter?
Ah, well, that would be a much tougher job to do because the spacecraft you're talking about, the Juno spacecraft, is really quite small. Of course, in comparison, it's a satellite that left Earth 5 years ago with the express mission of trying to figure out what the inside of Jupiter is like. We've done a tremendous amount of work looking at the thin ring of Jupiter, looking at the upper surface of the atmosphere of Jupiter, looking at the moons of Jupiter, all those interesting things. But in reality, we've only looked at about 1% to 2% of the bulk of Jupiter itself. So the Juno spacecraft, which will be there for about a year, will be looking at the interior, and it arrives today. That polar orbit will be an 11-day orbit that takes it as close as 3,100 miles above the surface of Jupiter, which is really quite close, out to about 1.2 million miles. But this is done intentionally because the radiation atmosphere around Jupiter is so intense, the electronics really can't stand to be bathed in it for a very long time. But after a year, the buildup of radiation damage, the dosage that it has received over that year, will have been enough to fry most of the electronics.
What's the ultimate fate of the craft?
Well, the ultimate fate of the craft is that it's going to be crashed into the surface of Jupiter altogether. And the reason why this is being done is to make sure that any microbial hitchhikers from Earth won't have an opportunity to contaminate some of the moons of Jupiter that might be a possible location for the development of life in a liquid water ocean underneath a frozen icy crust.
Jupiter, among the gas giants. So isn't it gas even at the core?
Once you get it to really high pressures with masses that enormous, it can change the physical structure of the substance itself. So we talk often about metallic hydrogen. So there may be some other state of hydrogen that exists inside the planet at great depth that we really don't know yet.
One thing we do know also on this 4th of July holiday, Earth is at its greatest distance from the sun.
Yes, here we are almost 3 million miles farther away from the sun today than we were back on January 3rd. On January 3rd of this year, we were only 91,400,000 miles out. Now we are 94,500,000 miles out. So if you're trying to figure out about the temperatures, you can easily see that it has nothing to do with the proximity of the Earth to the sun. It's all about the tilt of the Earth on its axis. For this portion of the year, the northern portion of the Earth has the axis tilted toward the sun. So the concentration of energy we receive is much higher now than it is during our winter months.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Derek Pitts spoke with NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller. Independence Day festivities continue across the Philadelphia region with parades, concerts, and fireworks. As WHYY's Kevin McCrory reports, the holiday was especially meaningful for 13 families who celebrated their new citizenship at a ceremony Monday afternoon at the Betsy Ross House.
I pledge allegiance to the flag, the United States of America, and to the Republic.
13 children from 10 countries around the world celebrated their new citizenship status in a patriotic ceremony before their recently naturalized parents. Eileen Chua and her husband Don, born in the Philippines, beamed with pride to see their son Reese take the citizenship oath.
It's a privilege for us. It's really our dream to, you know, to come here and to become a citizen of the United States of America.
Children ages 5 to 13 from Egypt to India, Vietnam to Yemen participated in the ceremony. As they accepted their citizenship certificates, each rung a bell to commemorate the 13 original colonies. Afterward, Carmen Perez, born in Venezuela, was overjoyed for her 12-year-old daughter, Sofia.
I feel so happy. It's really, really happy. It's a great opportunity here.
4th of July festivities are continuing into the night. A free 5-hour concert on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway kicked off at 5 p.m. Headlining is 26-year-old soul singer Leon Bridges, best known for his hit, Coming Home.
Baby, 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 I'm coming home.
The National Weather Service forecasts heavy rain and possible thunderstorms after 9 p.m. Wawa Welcome America says the concerts and fireworks will go on no matter the weather. Kevin McCory, WHYY News.
Only one that I want, wanna be your ride.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Dave Heller returns tomorrow evening. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Identity theft is a major hazard in our online lives. In a new trend, instead of stealing sensitive files, hackers hold them hostage and demand that owners pay up. We'll hear about ransomware on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Linder for NewsWorks Tonight.